Continuing now, hour number two underway in this two-hour weekend get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison, your anchor. Carol Marx, your host. And here now is Carol Marx in conversation with Bill Powers. He's the editor of Powers Energy Investor, and he sits on the board of directors of Calgary-based Arsenal Energy. He's going to talk about his new book titled Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth, published by New Society Publishers.
Now, what motivated you to write this book and, in fact, become a whistleblower on what's going on in the natural gas industry, and in particular, shale gas?
Well, as someone who knows a lot about the industry, has invested in the industry, I sit on the board of directors of an oil and gas company based in Calgary. I have a lot of insight into what's actually going on in the industry, and it is very different from what is being publicly talked about by industry, government, and there was a huge disconnect. And then this goes back to about 4 or 5 years ago when we had heard many outrageous claims about the potential of shale gas. And what I was seeing from well performance and from the studies I was doing on what was actually going on was very, very different. And the more I researched, the more I found a bigger disconnect between the perception and reality. So that was the genesis of this book.
Now, one of the myths out there that is helping to fuel a coming gas supply meltdown is the myth that we have close to 100 years reserve of cheap natural gas. What was the truth that you found out about the supply of natural gas in the future?
Well, we have about a 6 or 7 year supply of shale gas, as well as probably another 6 or 7 year supply of, if you combine conventional offshore coal bed methane left. And that is, while that's a significant amount, it is nowhere close to a 100-year supply, and it certainly is nowhere close to a large enough reserve base to encourage additional consumption, which is exactly what happened leading up to the 1970s gas crisis. There was a lot of conversion from coal-fired power plants to natural gas-fired power plants. There was encouragement to find new uses for gas, such as home heating, really became prominent in the 50s and 60s. And then there was a gas crisis of the 1970s into the early 80s that saw several hundred thousand people lose their jobs, many industrial concerns, shutting down either temporarily or permanently, a rise in electricity, home heating, and food costs. And this is what I talk about in the book. There are many parallels to the period leading up to the 70s gas crisis and what we're seeing today.
And in addition to what went on in the 1970s, which we're seeing today in, you know, more people converting to natural gas and industry doing that, don't we also have the fact that a lot of our coal-producing plants are shutting down or going out of business? And so that makes natural gas more attractive.
Correct. What we're seeing is a huge conversion from coal to natural gas. We are seeing legislation really start to take effect by 2015. It's called MATS, which is mercury, which is really to reduce mercury in the air through that is generated by coal-fired power plants. So a lot of producers are forced to shut down these plants rather than make expensive retrofits to bring them into compliance. So we could lose up to 10% of our coal generating capacity in the next 18 months due to this legislation that will really take effect in 2015. And then we're also seeing the age of the nuclear generating fleet in this country has forced the shutdown of 4 nuclear reactors this year, and that is the permanent shutdown. And these are going to be very costly undertakings for these reactors to be dismantled safely in accordance with all the Nuclear Regulatory Commission laws. So if we see this, we're becoming increasingly dependent on natural gas to generate electricity. And this is something that I think is very dangerous, because what most people don't know in the 1970s or have forgotten is that between 1971 and 1984, gas production dropped 20%. Despite the fact that prices went up 12-fold.
Why?
Because we had depleted most known reserves that were the major producing fields in Texas and Louisiana. Those fields were into steep decline, and prices were not high enough to satisfy demand. And so what we're seeing now is we have record high demand, and we have the perception that prices will stay low for the foreseeable future. But yet the way we got out of the 1970s gas crisis was not through drilling enough wells to bring production up. Production went down in, due to the maturity of the fields. And the way we did it was we built dozens of nuclear power plants, and we built hundreds of coal-fired power plants to destroy demand. And this was a very painful process for millions upon millions of Americans. And we're heading down that same path.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting that I learned from your book is when you looked at the gas well data, how much was being produced state by state, and you said that it really, that the gas wells are running on a treadmill, and that was horribly fascinating. So what is going on with that?
Due to the nature of shale gas wells, which have very steep decline rates through their first 5 years of life, is that you have to keep drilling more wells and keep putting more wells into production to keep production flat. And the estimate that just to keep production flat this year would need an investment of about $42 billion in the United States, which is far in excess of the cash flow being generated from all natural gas producers combined. So, you know, we will need higher prices. And what is very difficult message to get across to people is that several of the biggest shale gas plays are already into decline. The Barnett Shale, the Haynesville Shale,
wow.
Woodford, and the Fayetteville are all into decline now. And the only field that is really keeping us from immediately heading into a gas crisis is the Marcellus of Pennsylvania. And that is now seeing production start to flatten out. So we could be in for a very big change in prices in the next 12 months.
Wow. Now, what I found so helpful about your book, Bill, is you offer some ways that we can ease the effects of a future gas crisis. You mentioned alternative energy sources such as solar and wind and perhaps smaller, safer nuclear plants. What I found really interesting was you talk about the fact that we need to increase the efficiency in our power plants and grid system. So why is that so important, and how can we go about doing that?
Yes, there's a couple ways. For just to put some numbers behind this, we lose about 10% of all electricity generated in this country through line loss, which is across the transmission lines into the point of consumption. So one of the things I am a big proponent of in the book and personally is the distributed energy, which is putting solar panels on your roof, having solar arrays, you know, on your property, or having communities own their own power generation sources, which may be solar arrays, which may be wind turbines, and generate electricity as close to the point of consumption as possible. Because with the reduction in the price of solar panels and the increase in efficiency in solar panels, this is residential solar is now at or close to grid parity in most parts of the country, and it is certainly at grid parity in California and other western states where they have high gas, where they have high power prices, or in California especially. And so now we've also come into the era where you can combine the solar panels with battery storage devices in your garage or in your basement that can store several days worth of electricity, and these are becoming widespread, and they're allowing for people to get off the grid or greatly reduce the amount of grid power they consume on a daily basis.
Now, what do you hope the average consumer who reads your book takes away from it concerning the possibility of another gas crisis and what they need to do as individuals to make this country more energy independent?
What I would say to everybody who reads this book is that the die has been cast for much, much higher gas prices. This is not something that is going to be drilled. We're going to drill our way out of this. But there's things we can do as individuals to mitigate this. And firstly, what I would recommend is looking at your own household on how you consume natural gas. And, for example, whether you're home or whether you live in an apartment, or for most people who live in homes, what they can do is look at, you know, whether I want to, you know, install a solar panel on my roof. And even if it's not to generate electricity, at least almost everywhere in the country you can have solar-powered hot water heating. And these were very prominent in the 1970s, and they were also, they're currently in use across much of the world, solar hot water heating. And this is something that, you know, pretty much everybody should look into. We also have ways to heat and cool your home without using natural gas. To do that is through geothermal home heating systems. These have been in use for decades, very efficient ways to heat and cool your home, you know, having proper insulation. But really what I think is important is getting to understand that over the last 4 or 5 years, prices have been depressed for a number of reasons that I go into the book, and that we are going to see much, much higher prices, and that even though it may be a little more difficult and it may require some time to research and potentially install some of these ways to reduce your gas consumption, they are very much worth getting ahead of the curve on this, because for those who are unprepared or those who do not see this coming, it's going to be a very painful few years when gas prices, you know, double or triple from today's prices.
So then is it fair to say really that the gas industry sold consumers a bill of goods that just wasn't true?
Well, that is, you know, to the surprise of many, this isn't the first time that has happened. I mean, there's an advertisement from the American Gas Association that is in my book from the early 1970s, and the tagline on the ad was that America has plenty of gas, we just need higher prices. And, you know, and it said America, and it was really, at that time, gas prices were regulated by the government, and the industry wanted higher prices. So the industry takes out lots of ads in print and as well as on television and elsewhere saying, you know, America not only has a very abundant supply of natural gas, it also creates jobs and really, you know, encourages, you know, it gives the impression that this is a resource that is going to be around for quite some time. And when the exact or at today's prices, that is absolutely not true. And, you know, and the book is, I have almost 600 footnotes that refutes much of what the industry has put out, much of what academia has put out, and surprisingly, a lot of what government has said about shale gas.
Bill Powers, in conversation with Carol Marks, his book is titled Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth, published by New Society Publishers. We'll be joined by our senior correspondent Richard Neer talking about medicine next when A Touch of Gray continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And here now is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Dan Hecht. Dan Hecht is the CEO of MDVIP. MDVIP is made up of a special group of doctors in 41 states who personalize their patient care by thinking way out of the box.
Doctors in 41 states are members of his organization, and he's here to propose a solution to the healthcare problem in this country, and boy, Dan, do we ever need it. So give us a short outline of what you do.
Sure. Thank you, Richard. I guess what I do is best described by contrasting what we don't do. And so often in the healthcare environment, what we experience is such a long wait, 3 weeks for an appointment, 3 hours waiting in the waiting room to get hopefully 3 minutes with a doctor. And we know that's not the way it should be, especially as we get A Touch of Gray. We need to focus more on prevention and wellness, the things that always seem to be pushed to the back burner in the hurry and the sometimes chaos in the physician's office. And what MDVIP does is help bring back that patient-physician relationship to the center of the healthcare system and focus on prevention, wellness, and a doctor who knows you and can become a great advocate. We're seeing great outcomes and great satisfaction by everyone involved.
Well, Dan, it seems that that's the way it used to be when we had the family doctor, and God forbid they even made house calls. They would come to your home and help you out. How do we get back to that? Is it economically feasible to do that nowadays?
It is, and I think it can be actually very affordable. So what our physicians are doing is exactly that. In many ways, it's going back to the past, but leveraging the science and technology of today and of the future. So our doctors do even make house calls when they're needed. They provide patients with their cell phone so that if a patient needs to call in the evening or on a weekend in an emergency, they get the doctor themselves because the doctor knows who they are. And the way that's done is, the core of our program is what I call an executive-style physical. So some companies have executives do something like this, and they pay $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 a year for it. Our doctors provide this type of physical to every patient every year that looks at blood work for cardiac disease, looks for the potential for diabetes, emotional stress, all kinds of other examinations you do with the doctor and lay out a wellness plan for the rest of the year. The cost is only $125 per month as opposed to the many thousands of dollars that executives may pay. And this, it's comparable to if you got a cup of coffee at Starbucks every day. People say it's a great way to invest in our health, invest in a great relationship with a doctor, and really, as you said, be one of the key solutions to healthcare in the United States.
Well, I guess the question is, how can your doctors afford to do this at this very reasonable price versus what others pay?
Yeah, I think our doctors are just dedicated to doing this. The healthcare system has challenged them so much that many physicians are actually leaving healthcare altogether. Our physicians are rekindling that love of medicine, the connection with their patient, and economically they do fine and quite well in this model. But their focus is on giving great patient care, great satisfaction, and they now have, instead of 2,500 or 3,000 patients a year, they're focused on about 500 patients who know they know well.
So the doctors can make a living doing this, and obviously if you have that few patients, it obviously affords more time with each one, more personalized care and service, correct?
Absolutely, and the doctors love what they're doing again. I mean, I'll give you an example. One elderly gentleman came in to talk with a physician, and they started to talk about the need for exercise or even just walking for this gentleman. But he didn't seem so excited or motivated, and the doctor probed and said, well, what would get you excited? And he says, I used to love throwing the football around. And this doctor said, it's amazing. I throw the football every day with my kids. You're coming over to our house this Sunday. And for a doctor and a patient to rekindle that type of relationship, that's the core of driving health in such a wonderful direction.
Well, why don't the regular doctors under our current system do that? Why can't they do that?
I think it goes back to the numbers of patients they're trying to juggle and the limited amount of time. So as I said, a primary care doctor in a conventional practice may have more than 2,500 patients. And as much as they want to focus on the patient in the exam room, they know there's 12 more people waiting in the waiting room. And I think that pressure just focuses the doctor and the patient to deal with what's the critical issue of the day not how to build a good relationship and a focus on prevention for the future.
Well, it sounds to me, though, like it's a numbers game, though, because if each doctor has 2,500 as opposed to with your system, you're going to need a lot more doctors, no?
I think that's true, and what we're doing is helping doctors see again and students see that primary care is an exciting career path in medicine. It's a rewarding one, and I think we're increasing the interest and awareness in primary care in the United States, and that is very important.
Well, and of course, if you can keep people out of surgery, if you can keep them out of the emergency room, if you can keep them out of long stays in the hospital, obviously you can save a lot of money in the healthcare system.
Absolutely. Just from our reduced hospital utilization, we're saving more than $300 million for the broader system. And when you look at it and you realize that 75% of our healthcare costs, that in entirety it's $2.5 trillion spent in healthcare, 75% of that is spent on chronic diseases, diabetes, cardiac conditions. And we know that more than half of those costs can be eliminated and prevented if we could help make not just medical interventions, but lifestyle changes, looking at nutrition, looking at exercise. And that's what our doctors are opening up in their relationship with patients, seeing how you can change the course of disease in yourself and in your family by affecting those small decisions we make every day.
Now, I guess the key question is, do current health insurance policies, and now with the coming of the Affordable Care Act, do they cover your services?
What we do at MDVIP works very much hand-in-hand with insurance and or Medicare, and it's quite compatible. So I think all of the changes that we continue to see in healthcare sometimes just leads to confusion for each of us as Americans, and an MDVIP partnership is something that says you have a great link to a doctor, a great focus on prevention, it's compatible with Medicare, and you've now got a doctor who can help you through the system as needed.
Dr. Dan Hecht, how can someone listening now get in touch with your organization if they want to find out more information?
I think the best way is through our website. We have a lot of great information there. It's very easy to navigate, and you can also find a physician in your local area quite easily. So that is www.mdvip.com, and at that point there's also some phone numbers if somebody wants to call and reach us directly. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
That's Dan Hecht in conversation with Richard Neer. He is the CEO of MDVIP. You want more information? Go to mdvip.com. Richard Neer joins us to talk about a legendary rock and roll impresario. That's next when A Touch of Grey continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Coming up in a few minutes, Carol Marks will be here with a conversation with Andrew Sean Greer, critically acclaimed author of the New York Times bestseller, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, and he has a new book called The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells, published by Echo. It should be interesting. But right now we're joined in a two-parter, part one now, and then after Ms. Marks' conversation, he'll be back. Our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, you and I look back over the years. We look at the generations and the popular culture, and we try to make sense of it all. 95 years old, Sid Bernstein died this past week, a name that is very well known to people who have followed rock and roll and pop culture for the past decades. Beatles in that conversation, perhaps unknown to the rest of the world. What's your recollections?
So he was the ultimate impresario, and he had seen and heard the Beatles and was bugging Brian Epstein, bring them over to America. And this was late 63, and Epstein, no, we're not ready, we don't want to come here. And he finally convinced them to come in February of 1964. He offered them $6,500 to play
at Shea Stadium.
Carnegie Hall.
Carnegie Hall, of course.
And it happened, I think it was 5 days after the Beatles made their first appearance, February 9th, on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Timing is everything.
Oh, yes, it was. And, of course, you're right, Shea Stadium came later. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the Beatles even made that much money to play Shea Stadium. Nobody thought it would sell out, and, of course, it did in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And then, I think the rest of his life, Sid Bernstein was known for trying to get the Beatles back together after they broke up. He offered them $1 million to come back together again. They wouldn't do it. He said, any charity of your choice, you pick it, whatever it is, we'll send all the proceeds. He didn't care about making money on his own on this one. He said, yeah, just get them back together, and they wouldn't do it.
From what I understand about Sid Bernstein, he often tried to do things that were more for glory than necessarily for money. He must have made a lot of money. I don't know what his finances were. I never had the pleasure of meeting him. But he tried to resurrect acts that had been fallen out of popularity, and he just seemed to enjoy the process of popular culture.
And don't forget, Carnegie Hall, up until the Beatles played, it was a very formal concert recital hall. No pop acts played it. And strangely enough, after the Beatles came in, he brought the Stones in, and their fans were so raucous and destructive that for years Carnegie Hall would not let another rock group at Carnegie Hall.
Do you remember back in those days that even the word concert was a novelty, that it was meant almost tongue-in-cheek, that rock bands don't do concerts, philharmonic orchestras do concerts,
yeah,
opera
exactly.
singers do concerts. So when you would say something like Bob Dylan in concert, that was sort of a provocative play on words that was meant to say, hey, these guys are so good that we're calling them something that they are not, that they are in concert, as if they were the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, which was, of course, prestige, formal, establishment. And now you think of the word concert as being synonymous with a rock event. It's a concert.
Yeah, rock concerts. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a break, and we're going to hear Carol Marx talking with Andrew Sean Greer, and then we'll come back and let's talk more about Sid Bernstein and that transitional period. Richard Neer is with us. Michael Harrison on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, which continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best. So take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, Visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here is the star of the show, the host, Carol Marks, in conversation with Andrew Sean Greer. He's a critically acclaimed author of the New York Times bestseller, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, and he's going to talk to Carol about his latest book titled The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells, published by Echo.
I'm going to start off by asking you about being the extraordinary storyteller that you are. It's certainly true in your latest novel, The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells. When did your storytelling begin?
You know, I think the moment I can trace it back to was fifth grade, when Mrs. Pompey had all of us write what were supposed to be novels. We wrote, I think, 10-page stories, and I loved it more than anything I'd ever done. I wrote a story about squirrels, and I got an A++++++.
Great. Great beginning, too, you know, and shows that you're interested in all kinds of things. Good observer. So now let's get to your book. Your main character, Greta Wells, finds herself as a result of electric shock treatment, really, that's what I'm going to call it, for depression. In conjunction with that, she's able to relive with those closest to her three different time periods in her life, the present. That's 1985 that she is living in, as well as two other years, 1918 and 1941. So it's such a unique idea. How did you come up with it?
Well, I've written historical fiction in the past, and people ask me, interviewers will ask me what time I would like to live in. And I think, well, I'd like to bring everyone with me if I'm going to live in it. And it made me think, would all of my friends and family be happy in, say, 1920? Or things would change for them. The women, you know, would be in a different situation in particular. And it made me think about setting the same story and characters in three different times. Maybe I could have a character who woke up in a different story every day and had to make her way.
In these different time periods that Greta Wells gets to live in, she has the important people in her life, Nathan, her husband, Leo, her lover, Felix, her brother, and Ruth, her bohemian aunt. And though these details are the same, everything going around her has changed because they're in different time periods. So how did you go about researching everything from how people dress to cultural norms to the effects of living during a world war? I mean, that requires a lot of research.
I had the great luck to have a research fellowship at the New York Public Library. I had an office in that main library with the lines out front where I got access to all the non-circulating materials, and I could keep them in my office for, I was there almost a year. So, but mostly you find yourself not reading research books, but little pamphlets and newspaper clippings and local papers, because that gives you the details the novelist needs to make it seem like life instead of just like research being put on the page.
Oh, you know, it all seems real, and you've touched all the bases, and even the little things, which I enjoyed about the decorations, the dresses, and another thing.
I'm glad to hear.
You know, so I also wanted to talk about something else that your book really made me realize, and that was that every era has illnesses which decimate the population. This is nothing new. So in the different worlds that Greta managed to find herself in, there was World War I's epidemic flu, then the AIDS epidemic, and now we're having in the 21st century really the Alzheimer's tsunami. So I guess we have to realize that we don't have to think always that we're going to be done in by the latest threat to our health.
Well, you kind of wish someone from the future could come and say, it's coming soon, the Alzheimer's cure, it's coming soon. It would give you some kind of relief. The way we could go and talk to people in the 80s or
Spanish flu, of course, there is no cure, but there's some way to prevent it. But, of course, now we just sit and think. We always think the world is ending, you know, whatever time we live in.
And somehow it's kept going.
Somehow it goes on, you know. Those horrible wars, you know, they go on. And Greta kind of has that knowledge but can't tell people. You know,
and
the
that's
ending,
tough.
The war's going to start.
That's a very tough thing, I think, for your character, not to be able to tell people what's coming.
Yeah, I had to think about that, whether she would be a typical time traveler and try to change history. Instead, she's not interested in changing history. She wants to sort of help the people in her life.
Absolutely. And she wants to try to make things right for her loved ones. And so with Felix, her gay identical twin, she tries to fix the problems he encounters. 1941, losing his wife, son, and job. But she finds that trying to improve things in someone else's life is very difficult. Don't you think that this is something people, particularly women, instinctively try to do? And you know what? It usually doesn't work, unfortunately.
I know. Well, I thought about that because, you know, I'm a bossy person. I meddle constantly. So I kind of thought what I would do would be to try to meddle. And it doesn't work out. You don't understand the complications, not just of people's lives, but their minds, what they are ready to do. And in 1918, people aren't particularly ready to have a modern 1980s take on the world. So she causes problems and a little heartache.
That's so true. And when it comes to the lives Greta could have lived in the years she was able to time travel to, there were different social and cultural mores of these worlds, as we have different ones now in the 21st century. But, you know, I don't think we always realize how our current or former cultural mores affected the women. So they really did affect the things that she could aspire to and kind of love she could have.
That's really the heart of the book. Thank you for noticing that. For me, that was trying to find how a woman's life would be limited, her choices, and therefore the shape of her life just by the time in which she lived. The same woman, how would everything have changed? You know, I look at my grandmothers, and I think they were born in the wrong time. They'd been born 40 years later, they would have blossomed. And instead, they sort of had to teach their daughters how to be liberated, and they themselves were sort of restricted.
And you know, you make this important point in your book, but you do it so beautifully that you can't help getting into it and remembering the words that you said about it, and it's helpful. Now, in the end, Greta must make a choice about how she wants to live her life and in what era she wants to live, and I'm certainly not going to give away the ending of Greta Wells. That would be terrible, but because I couldn't put the book down, I want other people to enjoy it in that way. But did you know before you started this novel what era Greta would wind up living in and who she would wind up with?
I did not know.
Wow, I'm surprised. That surprises me.
Doesn't it? It surprised me, too. Usually I know where I'm headed. And it was only partway through that I understood what... There was a great moment where I saw how I could make it and in a very satisfying way, for me at least, and that was very exciting. And so that was a nice downhill ride to be able to write to that.
And I love this quote from your book. What is a perfect world except for one that needs you? Any comments? Because I love that quote.
I'm so glad. You know, a lot of people have quoted that to me, and it makes me happy that that got picked out, because that's kind of something that she thinks about. You know, it's like being like, what's the perfect place to live except for one that needs you, that you're not forcing yourself on it. It's satisfying to feel that you belong there. That's part of belonging.
And, you know, we all need a purpose, and that's what feeling needed gives you. So it's vitally important. Now, for all your fans, Andrew, what new writing project are you working on?
I've got two projects, which is unusual for me. I have one that, of all things, is not set in the historical past. It's set in the present day. Makes it easier, less research, in San Francisco. And I have another one that is crazy kind of futuristic story that I'm just having fun with.
Andrew Sean Greer, in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells, published by Echo. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues with Richard Neer rejoining us in just a moment.
You're age 65, and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast, of our big two-hour weekend get-together. And we're joined again by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, earlier in the program, we were talking about the death of famous impresario and key figure in the Beatles coming to the United States, Sid Bernstein, who lived a very, very long and full life and colorful indeed. Did you ever have the chance to meet him in your New York days as a rock and roll DJ?
You know, I think I did maybe once. Mm-hmm. He always struck me kind of as a hustler, you know, always had an angle to work. The guy I remember, the concert promoter I remember, and I wonder if you ever met this guy, was Bill Graham.
I don't remember if I ever met him. I thought about that. Bill Graham was the legendary Fillmore East and the Fillmore West, and he too was involved in the careers of so many of the rock stars that really built the culture that you know defined the next decades. Still, the most played artists on the radio are the classic rock, you know, album rockers of that era, and I think I met him maybe once for a second. I've only been to the Fillmore one time, and it was that night that,
The night it closed.
The night it closed that you and I were part of the people that emceed the final night at the Fillmore. We did it on two radio stations. We did it on WNEW-FM in New York, where you and I worked, and we did it on WPLJ, the competitor, that were both broadcasting from there. They had the two big rock stations that you, in those days, different companies owned different stations, unlike today where it's all owned by one company, and or most of it is. And that was an amazing thing that the two competing staffs of DJs were the MCs, and we all worked together. And I remember one moment in time in that night, I had the microphone of both stations, one in my left hand, one in my right. I was the only one on duty, and there I was on the stage of the Fillmore interviewing the Beach Boys. Talk about a moment in time. This kid from Long Island, who wasn't even in rock radio 2 years earlier, standing on the stage at the Fillmore with the two biggest FM microphones in the country in each of his hand, talking to the Beach Boys. How's that for a memory?
Were they conversational then? Because Brian Wilson has been legendary in doing terrible interviews.
I don't remember anything. I can't remember that night. That night was so freaky and so surrealistic that I have trouble even connecting to the fact that I was there. You ever have stuff like that happen?
Oh, yeah. And we had only been in New York radio for a matter of weeks before that.
Yes, yes.
And what we didn't realize that a lot of the established New York radio people didn't want to stay. It was a Sunday night. They didn't want to stay up late. They didn't want to work late. They wanted to go home. They wanted to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically said, let the kids do it, which we were 21 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. So they said, hey, yeah, give them the microphone. Let them handle it.
It was very, very strange, very scary, very unreal. Well, you and I had a lot of experiences in those days. You know, people are blown away when I say to them, yes, I introduced Grand Funk Railroad at Shea Stadium. I mean, you and I were the ones, we were up there, the WNAW-FM disc jockeys were doing that. And I think you and I individually, we introduced the opening act, Humble Pie.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
you and
Peter
I.
Frampton.
Yeah. And Peter Frampton, he was with them then, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Wow.
Yes, he was. And the funny thing is, the thing I remember most about it is being on that baseball field and how the slope from the infield to the outfield, it went down like 2 or 3 feet.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
It wasn't level like it looked on TV. It looked like a smooth putting green on TV. You got on the field and it was bumpy and there were ridges.
Reality is very different than the larger-than-life depiction in the media. Got to go. Thank you. Let's bring this up again. Richard Neer, our senior correspondent. Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you, Beverly Santinello on the front line, our producer. Thank you, Carol Marks, for everything that you do for the people of this country. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for 2 more hours of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.